The white gunman has killed 10 people and wounded 3 others. 11 other people who were shot were black. The gunman was an 18-year-old who wrote a white supremacist manifesto online. What can bring about hate in a white person so much to drive 200 miles to a black neighborhood and kill 10 people? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what police have described as a hate crime and why white-black tensions remain at a critically high level in the United States, including a review of other hate crimes that occur in that country. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, Gerald Horn, joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe, who joins us from Detroit. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So we're looking at an unprecedented incident that has taken place. It's really sad to see things like this happen time and again. Gerald Horn, let me first start with you. This has been categorized as a hate crime, and in my intro, I'm going to relay that question to you, of which, how much hate can a white person have for blacks, and in this case, to have so much hate to build up to commit such a horrific crime, driving 200 miles, and then kill 10 people as a result, and that could have been more.
We have a very seriously profound problem in the United States of America. And I think it's important for your audience to recognize that on the one hand, this is an elite phenomenon. That is to say, if you were able to tune into Fox News, one of the major cable networks in the United States today, which also has interests in Australia and in Britain, and in fact in India as well, you would hear the kind of rhetoric, the kind of language that helped to drive this sick, demented individual to slaughter all of these people in Buffalo. But at the same time, it's a mass phenomenon. In a few days, I'll have a book coming out on 19th century Texas, where I point out that if you look at the liquidation of what we call the Indian population, the indigenous population of North America, it not only came from mandates from the top, it came from actions by poor European settlers who wanted to seize the land of the Indians. And likewise, you have a number of white American working class and middle class people today who are rather easily manipulated by this point that supposedly the reason they're not doing very well in the economic marketplace is not because of the elites bringing down $14 million, $15 million salaries on an annual basis, but because of the fact that black people are stealing their jobs, that Mexican Americans are stealing their jobs, that immigrants are stealing their jobs, because we have both an elite problem and a mass problem, it makes it even more difficult to solve.
Well, looking at what was described as one of the things that this white male had in terms of, or is in terms of his character makeup, Abayomi Azikiwe, is that he was called a white supremacist. So naturally, looking at the definition, which you can tell us what that is exactly. But then looking deeper into this, came across a terminology that it was called replacement theory from one outlet, and then it seems like the more prevalent term is called white genocide. I'd like for you to put that into context for us, the difference there, because white genocide, I think white supremacist falls under that, if I'm correct to understand it. Perhaps you can tell us, Abayomi Azikiwe.
Well, thank you. The white supremacist ideology is deeply rooted in United States history, its institutions. This was founded as a white supremacist state going all the way back to the British colonies, the Dutch colonies in the Northeast. So this is nothing new. These mass executions, lynchings have been carried out from the period of enslavement all the way through the post-Reconstruction period, all the way into the 20th century. If we look just over the last several years, Dylann Roof walked into a historic African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, and killed a number of black people based upon the same delusional racist ideological issues. So this is continuing inside the United States. Racist was...
I'm going to get back to you, Abiyomi. Let me get to Gerald Horn with this question about what is white supremacist and what is this white genocide, which is something that this particular person was known to follow, which includes a whole variety of things, which basically is about how white replacement is being thrown about. It calls it a... Many call it a conspiracy theory, but this particular person and many others like him believe in that. Can you please tell us what white genocide is?
Well, this fallacy of white genocide is the idea that there is some sort of plot to reduce or replace the population that is defined as white by Mexican immigrants, by Haitian immigrants, by African immigrants. The problem is that from the inception of this settler state and the settler colonies going back to the 1500s, about 500 years ago, this has been a territory that has been populated not only by people of European descent, but by people of non-European descent. The difference was that historically, the people of non-European descent were treated in a third-class or fourth-class manner. But the issue is that over the centuries, we've been able to organize, and now we are only treated in a second-class manner. And many of those who are defined as white object to that. They think we should be treated in a fourth-class manner. And that leads to this idea of white genocide, the fact that they're not able to treat us as if we were in apartheid South Africa in 1949. And likewise, this idea that they are not able to prevail. They're not able to necessarily get every job that they want in competition with black people, for example. And of course, they consider the ultimate insult to be that black men oftentimes date or even marry women that are defined as white. And that is the nub of the question.
Taking a look at the stats that are out there, it's alarming that you have hate crimes that have increased and it's at a 10-year high. I looked at the stats from the year 2019 to 2021, Abiyomi, and it states that there were roughly a little over 7,300 hate crimes, up from 7,100, and the highest number recorded since the year 2008. Now, when you talk about hate crime, obviously blacks are targeted. It's the highest category. So the first question is, why are blacks targeted? Which then brings about the question about hate crimes not just involving African Americans, but then you go into Asians, for example. They have now turned up to be somewhat at the top. And then, of course, you have Latinos in there. And then we can go, of course, into categories like Muslims and Jews. So what's going on? First, why are blacks at the top of the list here?
Well, if you look at the history of the United States, the ruling class in this country was largely built as a result of the expropriation of African labor during enslavement. And even during the post-enslavement period, there's still the super exploitation of African labor. We also see it in those communities that are of Latin American descent, Asian American descent, and hate crimes are escalating against all people of color communities. In part, it has to do with, as well, the changing demographics of the United States, the fact that people of color communities are growing in regard to their proportion of the overall U.S. population. And many of these people tend to vote non-Republican, they tend to vote Democratic. But the Democratic Party does not have a program that can encompass their needs based upon their social status. So eventually, these people of color communities and other communities in the United States will break with the Democratic Party. And of course, when that happens, there is the propensity for even greater racial conflict in the United States. We saw in 2021 with the attempted right-wing coup at the aegis of former President Donald Trump. And there's a whole movement out there that is really an extension of the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist organizations that arose during the post-Civil War period. And these were rich, wealthy whites that formed the Ku Klux Klan. People like Nathan Bedford Forrest, who made a fortune as a slave trader. He was a general in the Confederate Army, and he was one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan. So these policies come directly from the ruling elites here in the United States. So, and they're going to continue, and unfortunately, they're going to worsen in the years to come.
It's interesting, Gerald Horn, that our guest there says that, the fact that it's going to worsen, because I just talked about some demographics. So then what's left really are the whites, aside from the ones that I mentioned. But then even within the whites, there are there are frictions. For example, in Boston, if you go to the Harvard area, as opposed to the people who are over the river, there's clashes there in terms of just culture not mixing. And I'm talking whites within whites. So what's the big picture in the U.S.? I mean, multiculturalism obviously has failed, and yet it's gotten to a boiling point and crisis mode, as we see incidents like this happen where you have this white person come out and kill 10 African Americans.
Well, you have to realize that for decades now, the U.S. ruling elite has fought a very bitter struggle against the very idea of class solidarity. That is to say, working class people who are the majority and come from various ethnic and racial backgrounds uniting in order to get higher wages and better working conditions. Because of this war against working class solidarity, you've had the proliferation, I'm afraid to say, particularly in the population that's defined as white, of a certain kind of racial and ethnic chauvinism. Indeed, it's not accidental, I'm afraid to say, that this massacre took place in Buffalo. Just a few months ago, you had a Democrat who also defined herself as a socialist, who was on the verge of being elected mayor of Buffalo, but the elites in the Democratic Party were afraid that her policies would lead to a redistribution of wealth from the top to the bottom, and they schemed to derail her candidacy and to make sure that she was. Likewise, if you look at the U.S. president, Joseph R. Biden, who cares about this racist massacre, recall that in the early 1970s, he got his start as a politician by campaigning and crusading against the very idea that there should be school desegregation by using buses. Supposedly, he was against the bus, but as Reverend Jesse Jackson, a leader in this country, might have said at that time, he was actually against us. That is to say, he was whipping up hysteria amongst the so-called white majority in order to deflect attention away from the fact that those at the top of the socioeconomic pyramid, speaking of the 1% of the society, are making out like bandits at the expense of the white working class, and in fact, at the expense of the entire working class.
Sure. Well, it's very interesting how blacks are being targeted, or African Americans, I should say, Abiyomi Ezekiwi, because the analysis drawn from that from some is the fact that the white, and I'm talking very generally, so pardon me for putting it this way, but I have a reason for that, because some are saying and deducting or analyzing, saying that, you know, the whites want to hold supremacy. I say that, and I want to put this next to this particular stat, which came out in the year 2019, that the cost of racism in the U.S. economy is costing the U.S. economy $16 trillion. 16. One figure from another source has put it at $50 trillion because of discrimination, and African Americans is part of that, including Latinos and people of color. If the U.S. government acknowledges this, which Biden did during his run as a president, when he was running for presidency. Why isn't it doing anything about it? Why is it still continuing then, the issue of racism, to the degree that it is, costing the government so much money?
Well, costing the government money is contingent upon what type of society we have in the United States. Racism, the super exploitation of labor of African people and other people of color communities is very profitable to the ruling interests in the United States. Disrupting that system would better the living conditions for the majority of people inside the United States. There's this divide, of course, between those who seek to bring about a broader democratic dispensation and those who want to narrow the dispensation to only include white males. And we see this in many different political debates taking place inside the United States. At this time, the U.S. is undergoing a very turbulent economic period with hyperinflation that we haven't seen in the last 40 years. And this is going to have a disproportionate impact on African Americans and people from the Latino community, as well as working class whites. So interjecting these hate messages in the white community to make it appear as if black people and brown people and indigenous people and Asian people, Muslims, women are taking away something that should be by right belonging to white men is a very dangerous ideology. And I don't think the growing people of color community inside the United States is going to tolerate this in the long term. African Americans have struck back against racist violence, and they will continue to do so. And it remains to be seen if these whites who are attempting to move the United States that far to the right will be successful. It's really open to question whether they will be or not, because in doing that, they're going to have to move against a great number of their own people.
Okay, so are we at that point, Gerald Horn, or have we passed it where we're going to see some kind of uprising? We see the protests happening when you have police brutality cases that involve, for example, a white police officer and how he has killed an African-American. We've seen that incident a number of times. But has it reached the crisis point where the uprising is going to be in large numbers and masses in the U.S.?
Well, that's one option. That is to say, a mass uprising that will beat back thoroughly and decisively the racists. Another option, I'm afraid to say, is the option of U.S. fascism. I would dare say that there are the seeds of fascism in the United States as we speak, based upon the point, as already has been mentioned, that the United States was built as a settler society involving liquidation of the Native Americans and expropriation of the labor of the Africans. However, I will also say that just as this racist terrorist in Buffalo received aid and comfort from abroad, the idea of replacement theory that he was spouting actually is an import from France that has been adapted in the United States. I think also that the fascists can be defeated, the terrorists can be defeated with international solidarity. Because keep in mind that if these fascists actually gain more power in the United States today than they wield at this particular moment, it will not only be people of color and black people in particular who are treated atrociously, this will inevitably be exported. That has been the lesson of US, the United States. That is to say, the problems in the United States do not necessarily stay inside of the United States. Inevitably, they're exported abroad, which is one of the reasons of why I would make an urgent and passionate call to our friends in Iran to rally to our defense, because this would not only be an act of charity on your part towards people struggling against dehumanization in the United States of America, it would be in your own self-interest as well.
Sure. It's interesting you use the terminology, dehumanization. But what was also very interesting, which I think is going to be the last question here, Abiyomi Azikiwe, is one of the things that this 18-year-old mentioned that he got his idea for doing and executing what he did was from the Brenton Harrison Tarrant case in Australia, in which you had him, you know, doing that live streaming and killing 51 people. And of course, this was in a mosque, and Muslims were targeted. I mentioned before that there are Jewish people that fall on those, under this white supremacy, which some call conspiracy, of which they're saying that you know what, there's a plan that whites are being eliminated. Are there going to be? Is there a social crisis that the U.S. is engulfed in, where you have different demographics that may be you know, fighting each other? When you see cases like what we just what we have witnessed with the killing of these 10 people, African Americans?
Most definitely. All you have to do is live in a U.S. city, whether it is a majority African American. I live in Detroit, or in other cities like New York City, Los Angeles, Seattle. And you can see the growing class divisions. You can see the racial polarization that is taking place. And unfortunately, neither of the two dominant political parties inside the United States has any program to address these issues.
They are being
fester. Yeah, they're allowing these problems to continue to escalate. And as long as they escalate, it's going to worsen the capacity of the United States to act in any type of unified fashion. And it's just going to worsen the overall social conditions inside the United States.
Okay.
And
I can give Gerald Horn, I can give Gerald Horn 30 seconds there. Gerald Horn, so you said that Iran could help, but let's put the context domestically. In your capacity, what can you do, and what would you advise others in order to stop this crisis that the U.S. is experiencing between different classes?
Well, the elephant in the room is the proliferation of weapons. It was quite simple and easy for this terrorist to buy a weapon, even though he explicitly said that it could be used to kill human beings. Unfortunately, there is a logjam in Congress with regard to circumscribing the sale of weapons. If you don't want to circumscribe the sale of weapons, of course, you could circumscribe the sale of bullets. But unfortunately, there's no political will for either.
Thank you very much for that, Gerald Horn there, professor of African-American Studies at the University of Houston. Thank you for your thoughts. And editor of the Pan-African Newswire, Abiyomi Azikiwe from Detroit. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikaba Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, Let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
الذي خلق السماوات والأرض وما بينهما في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش الرحمن فاسأل به خبيرا.
He who created the heavens and the earth and what is between them in 6 days and then established himself above the throne, the most merciful. So ask about him one well informed.
Dear listeners, we were discussing the 59th verse of Surah Al-Furqan. الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ ثُمَّ اسْتَوَى عَلَى الْعَرْشِ الرَّحْمَنِ فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا. Who created the heavens and the earth and what is between them in 6 days, then he established himself on the Arsh, the beneficent God, ask then from him who is aware of everything. We concluded earlier that this verse is stating the power of the Almighty Allah in the entire universe. It is describing the assured trust in another way, which was discussed in the previous episodes. Anyway, the verse is stating that the creation of the world is gradual. And at the same time it is created, it is under the omnipotence and under the authority of the Almighty Allah. Because the verse says, ثُمَّ اسْتَوَى عَلَى الْعَرْشِ. This beneficent God has established himself on the Arsh. And now that your God has such attributes, فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا. Ask what you need from him who is aware of everything. So we understand that we must ask someone who is beneficent, who has the ability and the attribute of giving us something that we need. الرحمن فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا. This is the beneficent God that you should ask from. And asking is not a defect. There is no problem in asking. The main problem is for not knowing. And this is the true fault and defect. Not to have the courage to ask. So in Islamic literature, based on this school of thought, we must refer to the ones who are the experts in that field. فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا. In every situation, in every aspect, we must refer to someone who is aware, who is completely expert in that field. And in our case, the field of living in the world and reaching salvation in the other is only on the hands of the Almighty Allah and His expertise. So this sentence, فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا, is, as a matter of fact, the result of the former discussions. It implies that the Holy Prophet ﷺ must declare that he does not want any reward from them, and they must trust Allah, who has all these attributes, that is. He is both the powerful, the beneficent, and all-merciful, all-aware, and omniscient. Thus, man must ask him whatever he wants.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The commentators have other opinions also about this sentence. They mostly have interpreted the Quranic word fas'al, ask here, as to ask questions or to question and not demanding. They say that the concept of this sentence is that if man wants to ask questions about the creation and power of Allah, he must ask Allah himself because he knows everything. And in this field, the field of creation and power of Allah, you have no one else to turn to. No expert is there but Almighty Allah. But some others have not only interpreted ask as ask question or to question, but also they say that the purpose of the Quranic word khabir is Gabriel or the prophet of Islam. That is, if anyone has the question about Allah's attributes, he must ask them. Of course, this last commentary seems very unlikely. Also, the commentary that says the meaning of fas'al is only to ask and to question and not to demand, and you should ask Allah himself if you have got any questions regarding the power and creation of Almighty Allah, is not seemingly very consistent with the former verses. So the meaning which says to ask Allah whatever what someone wants seems more probable, because the whole creation of this universe, all the creatures are created based on Almighty Allah's mercy. Because the word Ar-Rahman is used in the middle of this verse. ثُمَّ اسْتَوَى عَلَى الْعَرْشِ الرَّحْمَنِ فَاسْأَلْ بِهِ خَبِيرًا. He has established himself on the Arsh. He is the Beneficent. Now you should ask him because he is aware of everything. And not just the creation of this world is based on Ar-Rahman. The whole creation of ruling, the creation of the human beings, the creation of the world, and also the system which is going to be held in hereafter and resurrection is also based on rahmah. Because the Holy Quran says, كَتَبَ عَلَى نَفْسِهِ الرَّحْمَةِ لَيَجْمَعَنَّكُمْ. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. When faith begins,
our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Sharing the same mindset toward the U.S., Iran and Cuba are set to expand their partnership. Cuba's Deputy Prime Minister Ricardo Cabrizas made this comment in Tehran at the 18th meeting of the Iran-Cuba Joint Economic Commission.
I would like to reiterate Cuba's resolute will to expand its ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran in all areas. We are here to find solutions to illegal measures taken against us by our common enemy.
Iran and Cuba have already had close ties in the health sector. Pastokovac is a COVID vaccine produced jointly by Iranian and Cuban biotech firms. The two sides now hope to build on this successful cooperation and extend it to other fields.
Pastokovac's been one of the major vaccines that are injected to our people today. It's a result of successful joint efforts made by Iranian and Cuban scientists. We're determined to adopt the same synergy in other fields as well.
The 17th meeting of the Joint Economic Commission of the two countries was held in Havana in December 2016, shortly after the conclusion of the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5+1. Everything was going to change for better, but the reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, following the U.S. pullout from the deal, killed all chances for Iran and Cuba to do business smoothly.
Despite their long-standing ties in scientific and political areas, Tehran and Havana have not done well when it comes to bilateral trade. Last year, Iran's exports to Cuba were almost zero, with its imports standing at a trivial $2,500. Both sides are now poised to give it a jump start, but they need to overcome stringent U.S. sanctions targeting both countries.
Cruel and inhumane was how the two officials described U.S. sanctions. However, both are determined to, quote, neutralize the embargoes using non-dollar channels such as bartering.
Iran and Cuba's common enemies will never succeed in trying to stop our revolutionary development. We will work together with Iran to adopt bartering and other banking mechanisms that will render ineffective and United States' illegal and unilateral economic measures against our nations.
Based on Cabrisa's three-day itinerary, the two sides will sign agreements in the fields of oil and petrochemical industry, mining and nanotechnology, among others. Closer ties with Cuba, among other Latin American countries, come as part of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's new approach toward foreign policy and his attempt to avoid tying the economy to the 2015 deal. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A 74-second siren was sounded across the West Bank at 12 noon local time, marking the 74 years that have passed since their Nakba, the catastrophe. Demonstrators from all walks of life and of all ages held maps of historical Palestine and large metal keys to symbolize their homes from which were forced to leave decades ago. The anniversary also comes as anger is boiling over the Israeli killing of prominent Al Jazeera veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akleh.
Nakba anniversary has always been painful to all the Palestinians, and this year is more painful. Like every year, we commemorate our Nakba to tell the world that our homeland is unforgettable. That's why you can see people are still holding the keys to their ancestors' homes, as they still believe that they will return to their homes one day, and hopefully it'll be very soon.
Nearly 5 million Palestinian refugees remain scattered in different camps in the besieged Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, Lebanon, Jordan and Syria, including others dispersed around the world. All of them have a mutual dream, which is returning to historical Palestine.
Since 1948, Palestinians have remained steadfast in defending their right to return to their homeland despite Israel's continued ethnic cleansing policies. For Palestinians, Nakba remains a painful episode in history, and the agony continues to be felt amid Israel's escalated violence and crimes. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Yet again, London streets have been brought to a standstill by pro-Palestinian activists calling for an end to Israeli crimes against humanity in the occupied territories. Such events are building momentum, and the calls for the last apartheid on earth to be dismantled are growing louder.
Atrocities are committed in the occupied Palestinian territories on a daily basis, from ethnic cleansing to murder. And for decades, Western media has managed to downplay the severity of the situation. But now, with social media and so many cameras recording the madness, it's almost impossible to bury the truth.
Only days earlier, a prominent Palestinian journalist died when she was shot in the face by Israeli forces. She was reporting on an army raid in the West Bank. Her death caused outrage, and scenes of her coffin bearers being beaten by Israelis made headlines. 229 rights groups have called for Israel to be held accountable for what they call a premeditated assassination. At Saturday's protest, Shirin Abu Akleh's life and work was honoured.
I feel that we have the duty to come here and to do that and to speak out. For example, just Shirin the other day was murdered, and all the reports, the news channels, they're reporting it as clashes. Even in her funeral, the clips that I saw were disgusting. And still, again, the way that they are being reported is as clashes. Now, Germany, they wanted to hold a protest for the murdered journalist, but Germany was not allowing them to do so.
There is a trade relation between Britain and Israel, which includes arms sales. So this country, Britain, buys armaments from Israel, which are being announced as tested on Palestinian people. So people always think that Britain is arming Israel, but it is not a one-way street. Britain is also buying arms from Israeli arms companies, and there are Israeli arms companies who are operating in Britain as well. They are producing in Britain.
A raft of new measures limiting public protest were recently added to the already controversial policing bill, and it might also become illegal to boycott, divest and sanction entities like Israel, robbing public bodies of their right to make ethical decisions. It's the information age, and it remains to be seen how the UK hopes to maintain its democratic persona now that its grip on the media has loosened. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As higher oil prices mean more oil pumping, all of the big names of Iran's oil industry have assembled here to multiply the country's oil output amid rising crude prices. The 26th edition of the International Oil, Gas, Refining and Petrochemical Exhibition brought together 1,200 Iranian and 44 international firms active in upstream, midstream and downstream oil sectors.
We produce a range of medium-pressure and high-pressure cables, lead sheet head cables, for use in petrochemical industries and oil and gas. We have been operating since 1992 and have been supplying our domestic oil firms with our cables, which otherwise would have to go through the process of importing from other countries amid the complications caused by the sanctions.
Our company has been running for 39 years in the production of more than 400 types of metal fasteners and holders from various materials such as iron, copper, aluminium, stainless steel and alloy, among others. We have worked with major foreign companies supplying them with insulation, pipe clamps, cold line shoes, and so on.
For decades, Iran has relied on drilling bits produced by the U.S. and China to pump its crude. But U.S. oil embargoes on Iran have made it almost impossible to import quality bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This has forced Iran to try its own know-how to build its needed machinery, including drilling bits.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
NATO critics say the alliance's expansion is what led to the war in Ukraine, and now moves are afoot to provoke Moscow even further. It looks almost certain that Finland, and most probably Sweden, are to join NATO. Via video link, senior Helsinki officials set out their case to the European Parliament on Thursday as to why Finland would fit right in.
Finland has many high-end capabilities, including a fighter jet fleet of F-80s, gradually to be replaced by recently ordered 64 F-35s. F-35 jet fighters.
Sweden's Malin Björk asked, what's the rush given that her country and Finland have said they don't feel under immediate threat? However, it seems most EU lawmakers are supportive.
We think that it is not only defining for Finnish security, but it's only an important step in European history.
Finland's border with Russia stretches for 1,300 kilometres. Membership would mean NATO's land border with the Federation would more than double. The Kremlin has warned there will be military retaliation if the plan goes ahead. Experts aren't ruling out the possibility of World War III.
This creates a major problem because when you change the architecture of security, of course, you create waves of reaction and perceived threats, which is the case for Russia now.
The US and its European allies are spending enormous amounts of money on arming Ukraine. One EU lawmaker criticized this during Thursday's proceedings.
We have a very powerful arms industry in the European Union, and many nations rely on arms exports. We should be doing all we can to prevent conflicts escalating instead.
Analysts say it could take up to a year for Finland to fully join NATO, but in the meantime, it will become a de facto member. The question is, in the event of escalation, will it be viewed as protected or as a target? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Young people are those who most seriously bore the brunt for the COVID crisis in the European Union. A preliminary study carried out by European Cooperation Programme Specialised in Regional Analysis, or ESPON, has found youth unemployment across the EU went up by almost 22% with respect to pre-pandemic levels, with jobs going wasted in sectors affected the most by anti-COVID restrictions, such as hotels, restaurants and retail business.
Things have changed for the worse during the pandemic, definitely. I work as a kitchen hand and I've only been offered casual employment over the past months.
The COVID health crisis has been an eye-opener for many young workers. Suddenly, we found ourselves thrown into making a choice between badly paid, casual work and spending time at home doing nothing.
Food supply chain and tourism account together for about 35% of Italy's GDP. During the COVID crisis, hundreds of thousands of small and medium firms were forced to shut down, and a large number of young workers, the vast majority of whom under casual underpaid contracts, were left stranded. The Italian youth unemployment rate has traditionally stood at worrying levels. For almost two decades, youth joblessness in Italy has been more than the double of the total EU average, reaching a whopping 45% in 2015.
Today, young people bear the brunt for 20 years of political choices which have included austerity policies, hence jobs cuts and funding cuts to education services, and labour policies which have deregulated the labour market, introducing tens of casual working contracts which have left the youth unprotected and unwilling to consider job opportunities in Italy.
The ESPON study has also found that over 60% of people aged 18 to 34 were at risk of depression in the EU in 2021, with the deterioration in mental health being particularly evident among those who had lost their occupation. Max Civili, Rome.
The Embassy of Palestine in the Russian Federation organized a ceremony to pay tribute for veteran Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was killed by Israeli forces in Jenin on Wednesday. Her colleagues, fellow journalists and people gathered near the embassy to condemn the Israeli regime for what they called the heinous crime.
Shirin's a person I knew well. She was murdered in cold blood. This is a great loss, not only for Al Jazeera, but for the entire journalistic community. Shirin was very professional, famous, and her name was associated primarily with Palestine. She's long been a symbol for the Palestinian people who are seeking freedom and justice.
Abu Akleh's killing follows a long string of Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists. According to the database of the Committee to Protect Journalists, 24 journalists have been killed in Israel and the Palestinian territories since 1992. While 14 people were caught in the crossfire, others appear to have been deliberate victims.
At least she made with me at least 5-6 interviews. Usually we saw her everywhere, the checkpoints, Jerusalem, in Gaza, in Jenin, in West Bank, everywhere. Where we need her, we find her, exactly. She's a very active journalist. And we are, as Palestinians, we never make a differentiation between Muslim and the Christian, never.
Journalists who were with Abu Akleh, including one who was shot and wounded, said Israeli forces fired upon them even though they were clearly identifiable as reporters.
The assassination of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh is another crime to be added to the criminal record of the Israeli regime, which for decades has been trying to silence the voice of truth and obliterate the Palestinian cause. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Sandwiched between the towering Alborz mountain range and the Caspian Sea, Iran's city of Sari has been a hot tourist target for its spectacular natural sceneries. This has won the city the title of the tourism capital of the ecoregion in 2022. The city has invited the country's officials and foreign ambassadors to celebrate the designation of the title.
There are several criteria. For example, it's the historical sites, the beautiful nature, and necessary infrastructure for tourism. So all these criteria in general can contribute for the selecting and announcing the particular city or particular place in eco region as a eco capital.
Iran is among the top 10 countries in the world when it comes to tourism. We have a wide range of capacities from ecotourism to historical tourism and especially marine tourism. Our country has a 5,400-kilometer long coastline, which potentially makes it a hot destination for sea tourism. Now it's time to use our resources and strengthen the infrastructure such as accommodation to boost our tourism industry.
The Economic Cooperation Organization, or shortly ECO, is an Asian political and economic intergovernmental entity with 10 member states, including Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan. Sari was selected as the tourism capital of ECO during the third ECO ministerial meeting on tourism held in October 2019 in Tajikistan. The Tajik capital, Dushanbe, was earlier named the tourism capital of ECO for the year 2021. And Iran's northwestern city of Ardabil will succeed Sari as the 2023 capital of the ECO region. Officials say the initiative opens up new opportunities for investment in the designated city, which will help boost the tourism infrastructure.
I can say that many countries in ECO region are taking steps towards the facilitation of the issuing visas for the citizens of ECO member states. And so, of course, the facilitation or removing the visas, it's is important factor in increasing the number of touristic arrivals. Could contribute in the development of touristic sector in ecoregion.
From the Caspian Hyrcanian mixed forests to marshlands, wildlife refuge, and an amazing beach, the mesmerizing and diverse nature of Sari indeed deserves to be titled the tourism capital of ECO. The organization says it will continue the initiative and will name new cities as tourism capitals each year to boost cooperation between tourism entities of the member states. With its eye-catching landscapes and mesmerizing nature, Sari has already been a tourist magnet for mainly Iranian travelers. And now with this designation as the tourism capital of the ecoregion, the city should expect a larger number of foreign tourists to visit the city and enjoy its attractions. Yusuf Jalali, Sari.
On Wednesday morning, Palestinians woke up to the tragic news of the brutal killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the Jenin refugee camp. Abu Akleh was killed after being shot in the head while covering Israeli army raids in the northern occupied West Bank. Her killing drew angry reactions and condemnations in Palestine and around the world. Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, condemned in the strongest terms Israel's killing of the Palestinian journalist.
The Zionist enemy killed Shireen in cold blood, in another example of their brutality against Palestinians. Killing her exposes the violent and criminal nature of the Zionist regime. We condemn this brutal crime and we demand that the Zionist regime and its leaders be brought to justice for their crimes.
Shireen Abu Akleh's extrajudicial killing is further evidence of a trend by Israeli regime forces to systematically attack journalists. During the 11-day war in 2021, Israeli warplanes bombed several buildings in Gaza, housing media companies and news channels.
The Zionist regime attacks journalists in order to silence them and to hide the truth. By targeting Palestinian journalists, the Zionist regime wants to terrorize us and stop us from exposing its war crimes to the world. The Zionist regime doesn't want us to show its ugly face.
Statistics show that Israeli regime forces have killed some 50 Palestinian journalists during the last 22 years. During the Great March of Return, Israeli snipers shot and killed two Gazan journalists and injured dozens more.
This is not the first time Israeli armed forces has targeted Palestinian journalists. They have targeted a number of them during the Great March of Return in 2018. And this is also another addition to Israeli illegal practices against Palestinian journalists by killing Shireen Abu Akleh, one of the most famous journalists in the Palestinian territories. Israel is trying to kill the truth.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Israeli forces have been increasingly attacking journalists in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa
Principle Islam. Shiism is nothing but genuine Islam. Not only does not prevent the intellectual and scientific development of human beings, but also paves the way for this development and gives to it a humane and divine direction. And the scientific and cultural perfection of human beings after the advent of Islam has astonished the scholars of history. Yes, what I should add here is that moral corruption, conversion of man to mere consuming creature, and assessing all the values with money have all a different meaning from that of modernization of a country.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam and our deeds. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that if Islam is observed as it really is and as God, the blessed and exalted, has established it, then it signals the end of the colonizers. And literally, he says that the prayer for the death of the colonizers will be recited. Imam Khomeini has said that in Islam, we do not accept, we cannot humble the colonizers and the oppressors. So there is no way of accepting them. There is no way of bearing them. Therefore, we need to have the Islam in our society. We need to practice. It is our deeds which will show that whether we are the followers of Islam or not. And therefore, it is necessary for us to follow the Islam in its true way. And we need to observe the teachings of the Islam the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has established it.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala